I was asked to talk to you today about wives who've been abused, and so an hour really isn't going to cover it, and I've written and rewritten what we're going to talk about today at least three or four times, and I want to kind of set the stage for where we're going to go today by telling you a story. So when I was 17 years old, I grew up on a farm. My name's Chris Moles, by the way. I'm a pastor of a small church in a small town in my home state of West Virginia. We have about 1,400 people that live in Eleanor. It's named after Eleanor Roosevelt. And we pastor a small church there. And for the last 13 years, so I've been pastor for 14 years. The last 13 years, I've had the privilege of working part-time in criminal corrections. I'm not a criminal justice dude. My degrees are in Bible. I have an undergrad in Bible from Cedarville. Go Jackets. And graduate of the MABC here at Faith. So I've been working in criminal corrections for about 13 years, teaching different classes, life skills, parenting. And for the last 6 years, as a batterer intervention group facilitator, which is a mouthful. It just means that every week for the last 6 years, I sat down with between 15 and 20 guys who've been convicted of domestic violence. And that's been our life for the last 6 years. And it coincided with my degree here at Faith. And so God's just really been using these men to teach me about violence, and more specifically, violence in the home and the church's response. So to kind of set this up, I want to tell you about when I was a kid. So I grew up on a farm in West Virginia. And one weekend, my friends Bubba and Danny came to visit. That's right. I had a friend named Bubba. He lives in Georgia now, so he fits in a little better. Bubba and Danny came up to hang out for the weekend. My parents were out of town. They said you could have a couple friends up. And we decided to go frog gigging. Now, the boys had never been frog gigging before. You really know you're an experienced counselor if you can gig a frog. So they wanted to go. They'd never been. They were townies, right? And I grew up so far in the country, you had to go toward town to hunt. That makes any sense, right? So I take them down to the pond. And the way it was, you'd leave my house. You'd go down the hill. You'd walk through a pasture field. Then you'd open another gate and go through the pond field. And then you would get to the pond. So to the gig, for those of you who are inexperienced giggers, you need a flashlight, you need a poke or a sack or a bag. I liked onion sacks because they had the holes in them, and you tie it to your belt. That's where you're going to put your frog. And you need a gig. A gig is like a broom handle. We always homemade them, but now you can buy them. They're aluminum or whatever. But as long as a broom handle, and on the end, imagine a small trident, a little three-pronged like hay fork or whatever with barbs. It's a very humane sport. You'll see. And so one guy, you take the light and you shine it on the bank. And when you see a frog, you blind it with the light. I told you, very humane. And then another fella comes along and takes the gig and gigs the frog, rip it off, put it in the bag. And when you get a mess of frog, you take them home, you clean the legs, you fry them up, and you eat. Oh, my. And do you eat? So Bubba and Danny and I will make one trip around the pond. We finally spot a frog. I give Bubba the light. He blinds the frog. I can't get to it from the bank, so I have to wade out into the pond and wade back. Now, what I didn't tell you is in addition to the gigging supplies, Danny decided he needed to bring a paintball gun for some reason. Just as I go to gig the frog, Danny shoots it. Two trips around the pond, we have no frogs in the bag, we have a bunch of pink frogs in the pond, right? On the third trip around the pond, the light begins to dim. I look at the boys, I'm like, boys, we better get, right? There's nothing, you can't see anything, right? We get out of the barn, out of the pond field, lock the gate, take two or three steps, light goes dead, pitch black, can't see a thing. Bubba and Danny start to freak out, and I'm like, don't worry, I know where we're at. We take two steps, and we hear something over to our right. They're like, what's that? I'm like, it's probably a cow, don't worry about it, keep moving. Two more steps, we hear it again. Danny turns into the darkness and unloads. Oh, it gets better. I thought we were talking about counseling. We'll get there. And in the darkness, we hear, murr. Bubba screams, run for your life. And they start running up the pasture field. Now, Bubba's 6'9", Danny's 6'6". I was the little guy on the basketball team. And they go running up the field. Of course, I have to hose them off later because you know what's in pasture fields and you can't see. And I say all that to say this, and this is a reminder I've used in my life countless times. My wife is here. She's probably sick of this story. But the lesson is this. A little light makes all the difference, doesn't it? Stephen Tracy, in his book, Mending the Soul, Certainly not a biblical counselor, but a biblical man. He's a professor at Phoenix Seminary. He and his wife do tremendous work in Arizona in victim care. He says that domestic violence is the most misunderstood and mismanaged problem facing the church today. And I would agree, because assumptions are killers, right? Oh, if we had a flashlight, Danny may have shot the cow, but probably not, right? And the next morning, Snowball wouldn't have been covered with pink. But what happens in the darkness sometimes, we make assumptions and they really can be killers. When I was writing for today, I had originally started with a case study and a plan. How to deal with an individual counselee who maybe has suffered at the hands of an intimate partner. But it just wasn't jiving. Something was missing. So I did something I should have done at the beginning. I prayed. You ever been there? So sure of yourself until you try to do the work. And then I called some friends, and God has been so good to us. In the last 6 years, we have done a lot of ministry in domestic violence. And now on any given Sunday, you'll see two of our primary advocates sitting in our congregation. We're only a church of about 30, 40 people. But the state victim advocate goes to our church now, and our local victim advocate does. God's doing a work in domestic violence. And so I called my friends who work with victims. And I said, guys, what do we as pastors and biblical counselors need to know? And I was expecting some practical advice. But what I got was a challenge. And I want to pass that challenge on to you today. And that was this. My friend Nikki looked at me and said, could you remind them that domestic violence is a sin? Could you remind them that domestic violence is a sin? One shelter worker in a neighboring town put it this way. She said the church bus would pull up to the shelter on Sunday morning, and by that evening, we knew whether we had lost them or not. In some cases, they'd be back with their abuser by the Wednesday night service. I think we're shooting in the dark, is what I'm trying to say. So I want to give you a little heads up. I'm not going to give you a whole lot on victim care. We're going to try to do some. I've got two friends that are coming up later. I looked at their notes last night. Bev and Pam are going to share with you some thoughts, and I think they're going to do a wonderful job. So let me start with this initial thought. Domestic violence in the image of God. People are sacred space. Violence against another human being may show a lack of respect for the image of God, or just plain ignorance. We know in the book of Genesis that he created us in his image. Now, sure, the fall has its effect, but there is still something special about human beings. And any time we encounter someone who's been harmed or bruised or injured by the effects of violence, we should really take into consideration who they represent. Sure, us as Christians, we also know that we're the temple of the Holy Spirit. This is the place where God resides. Think about that for a minute. When we choose to assault another person, we ignore, whether willingly or ignorantly, the image of God. Think about how we respond to other people's bodies. That a husband in general is to love his wife as he loves himself. I guess what I'm trying to say is domestic violence ignores the image of God. It does so relationally as well. You know, we're called to relate to each other. Just as God relates to himself, he wants us to relate to others, to spur each other on, to be one body and to represent him. It's this God that reconciled us. He gives us a ministry of reconciliation, right? Reconciling the world to himself, not counting people's sins against them. Yeehaw. He was committed to us. He committed to us this message. So we're Christ's representatives, his ambassadors. As if Christ is making his appeal to us, we implore you, be reconciled to God. God is a God of relationships. Domestic violence sometimes ignores God's relational aspect. It also gives us purpose. We all know the story, instructions for us as husbands and wives, showing the world Christ's relationship to the church. But if we've been to biblical counseling training more than 10 minutes, you've heard this, right? That our goal is to please him. Domestic violence ignores the image of God. It also violates the will of God. It ignores the image of God, it violates the will of God, because God's very clear how he wants to treat us, how he wants us to treat each other, isn't he? How he wants us to treat each other. There's clear directives to husbands. Colossians 3:19, I call this the V8 verse. You guys seen the V8 commercials, right, where someone says, have you had your vegetables? And when they say no, they pop them in the head. Colossians 3:19 is like the V8 verse, right? Husbands, love your wives. Do not be harsh with them.